It's time for everyone's favorite podcast on the web. Pivot off the wall. Where you get the best sports talk and info in New York.
You lollygag the ball around the infield. You lollygag your way down to first. You lollygag in and out of the dugout. You know what that makes you, Larry?
Lollygag.
Lollygaggers. What's our record, Larry?
8-16.
8-16. How'd we ever win 8?
It's a miracle.
This is a simple game. You throw the ball, you hit the ball, you catch the ball. You got it!
It's an all-new Off the Wall on YesNetwork.com. And here's your host, Chris Sheeran.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Off the Wall podcast, Chris Sheeran and Joe Auriemma. The Off the Wall podcast is brought to you by DirecTV. Don't just watch TV, DirecTV. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. And on our first sponsored podcast, we have a very special guest, and that would be Jim Cott. Jim, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Always good talking with you guys.
Always good and an honor and a pleasure to talk to you as well, sir. And, you know, we have you on because yesterday, one of your buddies was inducted into the Hall of Fame, and as Joe and I were talking before we got you on the horn here, hopefully you're not too far behind him in Bert Blyleven. What are your thoughts on him making it?
Well, I'm thrilled for Bert. I mean, I know that he was frustrated for a while, you know, and he probably said some things that I know he wished he wouldn't have. And Goose Gossage went through the same thing. I think with those guys, the anticipation is so great, and then when they don't get in, it's like, well, you know, what's going on here? There are guys in that, you know, that were my colleagues that I had just as good a career as they did. And I think in Bert's case, not pitching in a mega market, even though he pitched on championship teams, you know, some writers, who knows what goes through their minds, but they just don't vote for guys the first, second, third ballot. Look how long it took Jim Rice. So, you know, I'm thrilled now for Bert, and I know it's not only is he elated, but I think he's relieved because it was getting near the end of his time to be eligible, and I look forward to going to his induction.
Yeah, Bert Blyleven, two-time world champion in 1979 with the Pirates and, of course, with the Twins in 1987. And he was unhittable in that series with the Pirates in 79, by the way. 4,970 innings pitched, 3,701 strikeouts, 60 shutouts, 242 complete games. These are numbers that you're not going to see again, are you, Jim?
Oh, no. I mean, well, that's the thing. You know, Burke, they say, well, he only won 20 games one time. But when you look at the whole body of work, you
absolutely
know, durability. Yeah, the durability, the shutouts, the combination of power and control. And, you know, then I think what goes into, I think, Hall of Fame voters, too, is they look at how much better were you than the teams you pitched for? Was your winning percentage higher than the teams that you played for? And in Bert's case, you know, he had some periods of time there where he pitched for some teams that that weren't always winning teams. And as you just mentioned, he was a very big contributor to two teams that won world championships.
Absolutely. And in 287 wins, they say that magic number is 300. But as you just said, Kitty, the fact that he put all these numbers together and was a very integral part in two World Series championship teams, he definitely deserves to be inducted into the Hall of Fame. Now, let's turn the attention to you for a second. Now, I know you might not want to talk about this, but just for the sake of argument, you know, I took a look at the numbers you put together over the course of your career, and, you know, 16 gold gloves, 283 wins, you had 180 complete games and 31 shutouts, a career ERA under 3.5, and you threw over 4,530 innings. You also won the 1982 World Series with the Cardinals. That's not too shabby either. Now, I don't want you to sit here and toot your own horn, but some of the numbers here are very comparable to Bert Blyleven, and you didn't miss the Veterans Selection Committee by much. You had over 59% of the vote. You need 75. But do you see yourself as one day eventually getting inducted yourself?
Well, I think with Bert getting in, that probably helps my chances. As time has gone on, I've become less and less, I don't know if I'd use the word anxious. You know, the early years that you're eligible, you think, well, you know, where do I stand? And then you realize, as I did early on, that it's a very select group that gets that kind of recognition. But, I would say my numbers, I was not as dominant a pitcher as Bert, didn't have the strikeouts or the shutouts. I would kind of needle him about that, the gold gloves and the home runs. And my 20th win in 75, ironically, was against Bert when I was with the White Sox, and we won that game 4-2. So, I wasn't the dominant pitcher, but I think over, a period of time, if you looked at it, they're somewhat comparable. So I just think that with Bert getting in, that certainly would increase my chances of that ever happening.
All right. Well, I'm going to play the part of your defense attorney here, and I'm going to tell ladies and gentlemen of the jury, here is my argument for Mr. Jim Cott. In 1965, Jimmy, you went against Sandy Koufax not once, not twice, but three times. Three times in the World Series. You got game two. You won game two against him. But game five and game seven, he got you. Now, here's the thing. You guys pitched game seven, each of you, on 2 days rest. And I believe you went three innings. But Koufax pitched six in game five and then pitched a complete game in game seven. Did they have pitch counters back then?
No, they had performance counts.
Yeah, exactly. But my point is, Jim, that you faced this guy, one of the best. He only played a short period of time, but he was one of the most dominant pitchers in Major League Baseball history. And you went toe to toe with him three times in the World Series, and for the most part, you held your own.
Well, I didn't have as difficult a lineup. The Dodgers didn't have the power hitting lineup that we did. But just in general, the 60s, it was pretty tough to shine in the 60s as a pitcher unless you were really on that top tier, because we had Koufax and Gibby and Marichal. Whitey Ford, the early part of the decade, was pitching well, and then along came Jim Palmer and then Seaver toward the end of the decade. So, and of course, that's why they changed the rules after Gibby had the big year in 68. And of course, a guy who doesn't get as much recognition as he deserves either is Mickey Lolich. And then you had McClain. So there was a lot of dominant pitchers there. And I guess it was Elliot Talbot, the MLB Network, that pointed it out, that I didn't even realize that the only pitcher during that era that had more wins than I did was Bob Gibson. So, it was kind of nice to be in that company and be, most of the time in the top five or top 10 during that particular era.
Wow, that's...
The numbers, just to touch on that, I think everybody gets so enamored with that. You mentioned the magic number, 300 wins. But, a lot of times a pitcher, you're dependent on your team's run support, your relief pitchers, and so sometimes you have years where you may pitch better, not get as many wins, and vice versa. And I know in my 600 and some starts, I think that the games that I started, our teams won, I believe, 369 or 70 games, and then I had 18 saves in addition to that. So you can do about anything you want with numbers. You can make a case and say, well, some pitchers didn't get 300 wins, but they were contributors to their team that won 400 games. So, like Jack Morris is a good example. What did he get, 258, 252?
Yeah.
He belongs in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, and, Jimmy, it's Joe Auriemma. How are you, buddy?
Fine, Joey.
I was just going to say, Jack Morris is a prime example. I think he's a Hall of Famer. There's a lot of detractors that say, well, his 3.90 ERA is what's keeping him out of the Hall of Fame. But really, he was a part of, great World Championships championship teams. He was the ace of those staffs. He was dominant in those World Series. I haven't seen a pitcher pitch like he did in the 1991 World Series, even the game against Smoltz, which he was just outstanding. And this is a guy that I think is a Hall of Famer. He just showed a lot of grit, and I totally see your argument.
Well, you know, you mentioned the ERA, and again, that's where you can do anything you want with numbers. And it's unfortunately, it's first of all, it's the Writers Hall of Fame until it gets to the Veterans Committee. And
right.
Now those of us that are still eligible that way, at least we have the opportunity to get judged by guys that we played with and against, and not necessarily just the media. But what the writers that maybe look at Jack Morris's ERA don't realize is Jack Morris was probably the last pitcher that just pitched to the scoreboard.
Right.
And that isn't done today. I mean, guys have a 7-0 lead in the ninth inning now, and they're still afraid to throw the ball over the plate sometimes. Jack
yeah.
Morris didn't care if he won 7-5 or 6-4. He wanted to pitch as long into the game as he could, and that's probably why his ERA was in the high threes, because he might have a 7-2 lead and give up 3 solo home runs near the end of the game, but he's still going to win the game. So, you can spin the numbers around any way you want. I always think a good comparison, and I don't say this disrespectfully to Wade Boggs, because he had a lot of hits, a lot of batting titles, a lot of all-star appearances. But if you were the manager of a team that had game 7 coming up and mm-hmm. you had to choose a third baseman, would you choose Ron Santo or Wade Boggs? I would think if you pulled most managers, Santo would win that deal.
Yeah, a couple of years ago, you had mentioned to me and wrote in a column that Ron Santo, was overlooked in the Veterans Committee vote. And, the late Ron Santo, another guy, one of the greatest third basemen defensively, could get a big hit at any time, was great with the stick. This is a guy that, should be a Hall of Famer. You're right. And he does get overlooked.
Well, and I think the fact that we're talking about this stuff, Marvin Miller made a statement when he didn't,
right.
He missed by a vote, and I feel badly about that, but he said he's become a bigger story by not being in the Hall of Fame. And
yeah.
So I think when Santo's case comes up, and I'm always flattered that at this time of the year, people, local paper here, the columnist Ray McNulty wrote a nice article today, they make more of a story of me being not in the Hall of Fame than if I was. And I think that's the neat thing about baseball. Is,
yeah.
It's that kind of a popular sport. You don't get that kind of feedback from fans and the press about football or basketball or hockey's Hall of Fame. So that's good for the industry that baseball is still, even though it's got a lot of scar tissue from things that we've screwed up over the years, but it's still a very, very popular sport with people here in America.
And you mentioned the scar tissue that's out there right now. And the big story is, the steroids and the steroid era, the scandals that went on. And, the writers have pretty much made it known that guys like Rafael Palmeiro, who only got 11% of the vote, Mark McGwire, whose vote total is decreased down to 19%, and even a guy like Jeff Bagwell, who's never even been accused, nor has he failed a drug test or anything else. Basically, the writers going on his physique and that he was a power hitter, he only gets 40% the first time he's on the ballot. So what are your thoughts on the steroids and going forward, what these guys, especially at the class coming up with Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens and, some other guys coming up. What are your thoughts on that, Jim?
Well, I think what some of them, even if they are innocent, you mentioned the word physique. I think the writers that covered baseball in those days sort of looked at a player's physique and said, wow, does this guy look different than he did last year? And then all of a sudden his power numbers went up. So he's kind of guilty by association. And as a group, it's unfortunate that they didn't get good enough advice to just come clean in the beginning. Canseco, as much as he's thrown rocks at a lot of his teammates, you know, in some cases he was right. And if a lot of the players that were using the PEDs would have come forth and say, hey, there weren't any rules against it, I did it, I wouldn't advise doing it, it's not healthy, it really skewed the record book, and they were honest about it from the get-go, I think most of them would get a lot more support, you know, just like going back before that. If Pete had admitted what he was involved in and his problems and tried to remedy them, which I understand now he's become very remorseful, Pete Rose, he'd mm-hmm. be in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah. No, you're right. And, you know, you mentioned Pete Rose, you mentioned all these guys, and, you know, a lot of... You know, over the years, a lot of these writers are going to have to, it looks like their stance is hardening on it, but it looks like they're going to have to come up with some sort of way where, you know, if a Barry Bonds or an admitted steroid user like Alex Rodriguez or anybody else, they're going to have to kind of justify. It's going to be interesting. They're going to have to justify to see, you know, if those guys get in, why didn't others, you know, some others get in? Jim.
Well, you know, I've always one of the answers might be if they continue to keep their strong stance against that, even if it's guilt by association, like you mentioned with Bagwell's case, he's never been really linked to that group. But those that saw him, you know, suddenly become this muscular guy, right away, there's that doubt. And I always thought in Pete's case, it would be good at Cooperstown if they had a. Almost like a little exhibit of everything that he did. And then it would kind of be a message to the young people that go through there that this is why he was not formally inducted into the Hall of Fame, and list, you know, the reasons why. And you could do the same with the steroid users. You could say, here's right. Mark McGwire, Barry Bonds, Roger Clemens, if it's Palmeiro, whoever it is. You could have a small exhibit, or you could have a plaque or something with all the names and their accomplishments, and say their numbers warranted being called a Hall of Famer, but because of,
right,
and then this is the reason they were not formally inducted. So that might be a way to have their names on display in the Hall of Fame. It would kind of be a lesson to young athletes at the same time.
Now, you mentioned before, one more for me, Jim, you mentioned before about, you know, the vote is really, it's the Writers Hall of Fame until it gets to the Veterans Committee. And I know this is probably never going to happen, but do you think that, you know, when the vote started years ago, they should have set a precedent that, you know, players, former players should have a say in who gets, you know, into the Hall of Fame that first 15 years, that it should have been more of a split vote?
Well, I think that when the Hall of Fame was started, it was started by writers, and it's the Baseball Writers Hall of Fame. So that's going to kind of be the writers' call. If they want to broaden that scope and say this National Baseball Hall of Fame, we want the players to have a say. But I think the writers sort of feel pretty proprietary about that. And I don't blame them. It is the Writers Hall of Fame. The fallacy in the system is that you have writers that maybe just came on board in the last 10 years. Maybe they didn't see Jack Morris pitch a lot. So, you know, they're really not in a position to pass, you know, to vote on those guys. It would be a lot fairer if the writers, and that's what they're trying to do now with the veterans ballot, is we'll, like next year, I will be more or less, evaluated by guys that played with and against me in my era, and that's a fair shake. But you should have the guys like Jack Morris in his era, say from he was the most dominant pitcher in the 80s, say through the early 90s. Well, you want to get writers and broadcasters that covered the game during that time and let them vote, and then get his 75% from those, not from the new young writers that just look at numbers and really don't know what a great pitcher he was.
Yeah. If I could just end it on this, Jim, I don't know if you've ever looked into sabermetrics or met a saber mathematician before, but I think that needs to go the way of the dodo, because I look at play on the field. I look at guys as waking up. Maybe they slept on their wrong side and they have some aches and pains. And all those numbers that they come up with, you know, in sabermetrics, to me they're skewed because you don't know what's going on in a player's personal life. I think what most people don't understand is, and they kind of put these guys up on pedestals sometimes because they're their heroes, is that they're human as well.
Yeah, I think with all the numbers, it's, you know, there are some guys, and that's why I always thought it was more difficult for a pitcher, a young pitcher, to make a mark in the game than a hitter, because a hitter, in a three-game series, can face one really strong pitcher and two average pitchers, and he might go 0-for-5 against a strong pitcher, but pile up some numbers against the others. So, you know, if there are some guys that are great at piling up stats when their team's either way behind or way ahead. And the argument I had with the late Alan Lewis, who didn't vote for my teammate Harmon Killebrew for a while, he said, well, all he did was hit home runs. I said, yeah, 573. I mean, if you followed the Twins, unfortunately, Alan, you were in the National League. You would have seen when he hit those and who he hit them against. You'd understand that, you know, he was a clutch hitter. He was like Tony Perez for the Reds.
Right.
He got big home runs late in the game against good pitchers. And those are the kind of things that the numbers can't really tell you. You have to be there to follow the player and the team to find that out.
All right, Kitty, we're going to let you go, but we'd like to thank one other person, and that would be Mother Nature for making the golf courses wet today so you could be made available. We hope the
good
next
– hey,
we hope the next time you hit them straight and you hit them well. Thanks a lot. We appreciate you coming on.
Thank you.
Right. Want to see what everyone's talking about? Check out the 2-time Emmy Award-winning video content at YesNetwork.com. It's the best in Yankees web shows, podcasts, and features. Only at YesNetwork.com.
It's Off the Wall on YesNetwork.com. Here's more from Chris Sheeran.
And a big welcome back to the Off the Wall podcast brought to you by DirecTV. Don't just watch TV, DirecTV. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Chris Sheeran, Joe Auriemma. Now we are brought to you by someone, and that
it's
would
good
be
good to be sponsored.
DirecTV. Maybe we should be Subliminal Man and just drop it in after every DirecTV, after every line DirecTV. We thank them for their support, and away we go. We want to thank Jim Cott for joining us in our last segment to talk a little Hall of Fame. His buddy Burt Blyleven, as we said, gets in, and as Kitty alluded to, maybe this does help him out in a way to pave his way to get into the Hall of Fame too, even if it's through the Veterans Committee because he's off the ballot now.
Right.
But we looked at the numbers. They are kind of negligible in certain categories, and he's not too far off, so I would not be shocked if Kitty does eventually get into the Hall.
Yeah, you know, and he said it best, you know, he looks at the Veterans Committee, and they now have said, okay, well, we played against Jim Cott. We know what Jim Cott's all about. His numbers are comparable to Burt Blyleven. Burt Blyleven said it in his speech yesterday that now I have an opportunity as a member of the Veterans Committee to vote in guys like Jim Cott,
right,
who I think is a Hall of Famer.
All right, let's transfer here to a little football action. Playoff weekend this weekend, wild card weekend. You know, it's amazing, Joe, that, you know, it's week one. You blink your eyes, and it's, you know, wild card weekend already.
Mm-hmm.
The Giants, as we know, will not be playing this weekend. I heard Jerry Reese yesterday, the Giants general manager, on the radio with our good buddy Michael Kay. They're in the evaluation process now. You know, they're evaluating all the coaches and the coaching staff. He said no one person is going to be the fall guy or get the axe. You know, everybody except Coughlin, because Coughlin, as they said, is coming back. It's his last year of his contract next year. And Reese said that he hates the term lame duck. He thinks when a coach is in his last year of his contract, he's in the last year of his contract. There's no such thing as a lame duck coach.
Yeah.
But as Michael very poignantly pointed out, Pat Riley was the first one to bring that into the New York sports talk vernacular when he was with the Knicks.
Right.
But away we go. I mean, let me tell you how I was thinking. And I blogged about this too. The last 2 weeks of the season, I wanted this guy out of here. I wanted Michael Corleone to walk into the locker room and say, you're out, Tom.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the Giants showed a lot of class and a lot of faith in this guy. He won a Super Bowl. He had an 8-8 season 2 years ago. He had a 10-6, and they collapsed. They were 5-0. The year before that, they were 12-4. That was the year after they went to the Super Bowl, but they lost Plexico Burress.
That was a more of a season. I know they had like a late season swoon there too, but that was more of a lot of stuff going on behind the scenes, and they lost to the Eagles.
Antonio Pierce is out with Plexico Burress, so the defense, you know, they say that stuff off the field doesn't affect them on the field, but in that case, I think it did, and especially with Plexico Burress not being available for Eli Manning.
I think Antonio Pierce definitely was affected. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, so because he didn't know where it was going. He didn't know if he was going to be
as much in trouble as Plex was,
whatever. So 12-4, 8-8, 10-6. You look at other teams the last 3 years, that's a pretty good track record, and a Super Bowl title the year before as a six seed against the best team in all the land who's going for the undefeated season, the Patriots. So I thought the Giants, even if they keep him for the last year of the contract, just to see, and they don't give him an extension, I think the Giants organization, and I'll say this till I'm blue in the face, is class to the utmost. You know, they rival the Yankees with the class of the organization that goes around. And bringing him back, I really think, is a good thing to do because Coughlin had to deal with a lot of key injuries sporadically during the season. They were healthy at running back, but the receiving core never had consistency, Joe.
Well, you bring up that point where Eli Manning had 25 interceptions this year, and of the 25, how many of them were tip balls? I mean, a lot of it is Eli's fault. He didn't have a great season. But, you know, you look at Mario Manningham, you know, these guys holding the ball out like a loaf of bread, tipping passes to receivers. They were great in some instances. Akeem Nicks showed that he could be an elite receiver in this league.
Everybody wants to get on Matt Dodge for that Eagle game. How about Mario Manningham? Because that's what started to change the focus
of
that game.
And the other thing is, if they had Steve Smith, you know, he was their big third down receiver, big slot possession receiver. He gets a couple first downs here or there. You know, and the game's over.
And even when he came back, you didn't know if he was at 100% with that pectoral. He was just playing. Then he hurts his knee.
Right.
And you got, like, a great guy like Soibert. You put him anywhere on the offensive line. Hell, you could probably put him at tight end, and he just wants to play football. And the loss of that guy, you know, that hurt everybody. In the locker room, you heard after the game, you know, they just beat the Redskins. They knew they were out of the playoffs, but they were so downtrodden because of that's how big he is in that locker room. So we just got word that maybe he'll be ready for next year. He had a dislocated right kneecap and a torn patellar tendon. So it could have been worse. I mean, that sounds disgusting, but it could have been a lot worse. When he went down and started, we were watching the game together, and when he went down, I thought ACL immediately because he hit the deck and he just started waving guys in.
Yeah. And
one of the toughest guys you'll ever see, and he's just waving people in to take care of his leg.
Just to show you how good of a season he had, you know, you look at when he was switched to center, you know, that running game was tremendous after he was switched to center. And when a Pro Bowler like Sean O'Hara came back, maybe Sean O'Hara wasn't ready to come back yet because guys were pushing O'Hara back.
We watched the game when the offensive line was intact again.
Yeah.
And they looked lost.
Mm-hmm.
They looked absolutely lost. They looked better as a unit before O'Hara came back. And I'm not saying O'Hara was the cause, but there was like a 4 or 5 week stretch where Deal and O'Hara were not in the lineup.
Mm-hmm.
And the offensive line started to come together with guys like Andrews, guys like Booth. And give Andrews credit till there's no credit left. This guy, I don't know how many injections he took for his back. I mean, he should be retired. He should not come back next year. I don't think he's going to. But the mere fact that that guy was taking basically epidurals so he can go out there and get pounded for 60 minutes, you got to give it up for this guy.
Yeah, you got to give it up for him. You got to give it up the Giants. They played a game where they didn't control destiny, their own destiny.
Well, they spit the bit this year.
They did.
We can't pull any punches. And Eli Manning, I don't care what you might argue with me, and I know Joe Callow, who does the New York football podcast, will argue with me till he's blue in the face. Eli Manning is not one of the top five quarterbacks in the NFL. I'm sorry. That's fact. That is fact. And I could rattle off five that are better than him right now off the top of my head.
Right, but I'll say this about Eli. When there are big spots and big moments, he has come up big for the Giants organization. He has come up very big in very clutch
situations.
I'm not
saying he's a bad quarterback.
No.
But don't put him in the elite. He's not Drew Brees.
No, he's not.
His brother had an off year, but he's not his brother.
No, I know. And he's not Tom Brady.
He's not Tom. He's nowhere near Tom Brady.
Tom Brady is above and beyond everybody else. So I agree with you. I'm not going to disagree with
but
you.
But there are Giant fans out there, and I know people who listen to this, you know, that follow us on Twitter are going to be like, you're crazy, Eli, la, la, la. No, Eli is not an elite quarterback. The ELI does not start the word elite, okay? He's not. Just face facts. He's a good quarterback. But he's not an elite quarterback.
You want to talk? Look at Phil Sims. Was Phil Sims an elite
quarterback?
No. But he was a winner.
He was a winner. He was a winner. He led the Giants to two Super Bowls. Jeff Hostetler won the second
one. There were
a
couple
one,
years
Phil
there.
Phil Sims got them
there were
to
a couple
point.
Years there where Phil Sims threw like 21 touchdowns and 25 interceptions.
He did.
And still led them to the playoffs.
He did.
That's just how it was. And, you know.
But you got to remember something back then, too. They weren't a passing team.
Right.
But
he was a leader.
Bobby Thompson and Stephen Baker are not really like Jerry Rice and John Taylor.
I'll say this, you know, because I know we've spent a lot of time on the Giants here. And
Phil McConkey. No offense.
Part of the YesNetwork.com family here. Come on. But
loved your restaurant, Phil.
I'm just going to say, Tom Coughlin coming back, I agree with the move. He wins that last game. They're 10-6 this year. They're only one of two teams in the NFL this year to go 10-6 and not make the playoffs, along with the Tampa Bay Bucks. And those two teams are only two of five teams since they reformatted the playoffs in 1990 to have 10 wins and not make the playoffs. So, you know, it goes to show you. And the 7-9 Seahawks are in the playoffs.
But this
so
is
just,
hey, you can't. That's the way the ball bounces in the NFL. And you know what? The Giants, with 8 minutes left and change in the Eagle game, went from the 2 seed to out of the playoffs.
Right.
Up 21. So the Giants can't look at the Seahawks and boo-hoo, they're 7-9 and we're 10-6.
No. I'm not going there. I'm not saying
I'm not
that.
Saying you are.
I'm just
but
saying.
But there are people out there that are boo-hooing that we're 10-6.
They won their division.
Hey.
They won their division.
They took care of business.
Right.
Your team did not. The Giants didn't take care of business. They had the playoffs, maybe a first-round bye in the palm of their hands, and like one of those little things that blows around in the summer. You know, I used to call them money catchers. If you catch me, you come into money. Guess what? Never did. But that's what the Giants did. They caught it in their hand. They just went, whew. See you later. Bye, playoffs.
Yep.
Whole golf course.
And the one game the Seahawks needed to win.
They won.
It was an awful game.
It was a brutal game.
And they're going to get killed by the Saints, I'm guessing.
Listen, hockey fans, I love hockey, but that brutal game on Sunday night got higher ratings than any hockey game will ever get. And that's just the state of football and hockey. But anyway, I'm going off. Looking at
Wild Card Weekend, though. I mean, Rex Ryan.
Saturday's a dog day.
Well, Rex Ryan.
The late
Jets
game is fine.
And the Colts.
But the early game is going to be tough to get into. Saints at Seattle.
And
that's going to be over after the second quarter.
Yeah.
At halftime, that game's going to be over.
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting game. I think the Saints are going to blow
them out.
By
the time halftime comes around in that game, you're going to be praying the Jets were on in 2 minutes.
So the Jets are going to Indianapolis. We're talking about, you know, how the Saints are going to blow out the Seahawks. But are the Jets going to go into Indianapolis and beat the Colts?
I think they can. I absolutely think they can. I think they could have beaten them last year. I think Schottenheimer got too conservative with his play calling with the rookie quarterback in Sanchez. I honestly think, and we've talked about this before in the podcast in the past, that if he wasn't so damn conservative in the AFC Championship game, and my thought process was, I'm not even a Jet fan, but I'm sitting there watching the game saying, you're in the freaking AFC title game. Don't get all, oh my God, I have a rookie quarterback. I can't throw the ball. Let the kid throw the ball on 3rd and 22. You got there at 9-7. You barely went into the playoffs. Your head coach thought you weren't even going to make it after a game. Mistakenly said, well, we're out. You're in the AFC title game against Peyton Manning. You're winning at halftime. And you take the offense and literally put it into a nutshell.
Yeah, no, I agree with that.
So if everybody out there is thinking the Jets are going to go to Indianapolis in Lucas Oil Stadium and get run out of the building, you're sadly mistaken.
There's a lot
because they've gotten better.
Well, they've gotten better. The Colts have a lot of key injuries.
Brackett's back on defense.
Here's a couple of keys, in my opinion. I think the Jets need to run the ball effectively to pound that defense, you know, out and open up that passing game. I think they can't be conservative. And I think, you know, it's going to come down to you're going to see where Revis and Cromartie are going to be covering, you know, Reggie Wayne and Garcon or whoever's the two that week.
The money is going to be where
the linebackers going to be able to cover Tammy? That's a question. Is Joseph Addai, are they going to stop Joseph Addai? You know, there's a lot of different things. I personally think the Jets are going to win this game. I think they're going to go into the Indianapolis and win this game.
I can't argue that. I can't, because the Colts had a worse off season than the Jets. The Jets had a better season than the Indianapolis Colts. And, you know, one loss and one Jaguar win, which didn't materialize, the Jets might be out of the playoffs, and so might the Colts. So I think this game, you know, flip a coin in my eyes.
And I agree with you. Would I be shocked if the Colts won this game? No. They've won four in a row. They were 6-6.
Joey.
They found a little stride here. It hinges
on the same thing the title game hinged on last year. Two words, one number, Mark Sanchez. Whether they put the game into his hands or whether he takes the game, puts it on his back, and leads the Jets to victory. You know, he had an up-and-down sophomore season. Usually it's the sophomore jinx. Ho-ho, that old gag. Started out, blaze of glory, had his issues. You know, people after the first 3 weeks of the season picked him up on their fantasy teams. Oh, my God, Mark Sanchez. And then they were, you know, distraught.
Right.
And dropping him. But I really think this game centers on number six. And if he has not a good game, he can't have a good game against Peyton Manning. You have to have the game of the season against Peyton Manning. Because I don't care how many points he's down. He'll find a way to come back and win the game.
Always does.
Come by hook or by crook. And he hasn't had a good season. You know, I always toot his horn. I always say, oh, Eli's not his brother. Guess what? Peyton wasn't, you know, he wasn't lighting it up this year. And he did have injuries.
It's not just the injuries, too. That offense is a real timing offense. A lot of those routes are based on, you know, Peyton's going to throw the ball, and you better be there.
And when you have new receivers.
Right, right.
You know, I think he had another.
And no running backs,
by the way. He had seven
picks. Addai was hurt all year.
He had seven picks in two in back-to-back games.
Right.
When do you ever see that out of Peyton Manning? Guys are running pick sixes back like they're going out of style.
He was
throwing
50, almost 60 times a game. It was a bad season for him.
But this game, I mean, this is like a divisional game in the first round that you're getting. So the late game on Saturday makes up for the travesty that's going to kick us off at 4:30. And thank goodness they're getting it out of the way Saturday early. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right, Sunday, the early game you have, the Ravens going into Arrowhead. Now, I'm excited for this game for a couple of reasons. Because the Chiefs are back in the playoffs. They're hosting at Arrowhead. That place is insanity during the regular season. So I could just imagine what it's going to be when the ball is kicked off on Sunday afternoon at 1 o'clock. The big problem for the Chiefs is that they're playing the Ravens. I really look at Todd Haley as doing a tremendous job. You know, Larry Johnson last year, you remember saying, you know, my father played football. This guy never played football. I don't know why he's coaching us. Well, Haley's getting the last laugh. He has a division title, and he's in the playoffs hosting a playoff game. So I would love to see the Chiefs win this game as the 4 seed. I don't think there's any way. I think we both picked the Ravens to go to the Super Bowl this season.
My
49ers are way out of it.
Here's my
oh,
thing.
Baby.
I picked the Packers and the Ravens to go to the Super Bowl before the season.
Yeah, you did.
And
you're looking very smart right now.
I'm going to stick with that prediction, and I'm going to continue to pick the Ravens and the Packers until they get beat. However, the Chiefs could hand the Ravens an upset. And I'm just saying it because they are in Arrowhead where the Chiefs are very good this year.
Well, who thought the Ravens were going to go to New England and did what they did last year? That was in English, I don't think.
I don't think
that was either.
You look at Matt Cass's numbers. He had a tremendous season. tremendous season.
Week after he has his appendix out, he's back on the field.
Dwayne
Bowe is a monster.
Yeah, this team is a very good team. I am going to pick the Ravens to win this game.
Okay, and we transfer really quickly to the late game, and this is the Jewel of the Nile. This is what Michael...
Which is, by the way, just an awful film.
Yes, it is, but I had to bring it up.
Romancing the Stone, much better.
DeVito was good in both, but...
Yes.
This is the Jewel of the NFL playoff weekend. You could talk Jets-Colts, but all you want. But I think Eagles-Packers, this is like an NFC title game in wild card weekend. The three-seeded Eagles against the six-seeded Packers. You got the Packers coming in, arguably is the hottest team in the NFL. Aaron Rodgers, although he didn't have a good game against the Bears, and as we were sitting there watching the Giants, we were saying, oh, my God, the Packers might actually lose this game.
Yeah.
And, you know, if not for a couple of Jay Cutler picks, they might have. But the Bears lose. The Packers win. They get the six. They're in Philly taking on Michael Vick and the Eagles, who have been just unbelievably powerful on offense this year. Everybody raised their eyebrows with Andy Reid. Oh, we're letting Donovan McNabb go. What?
Yeah.
What?
Donovan McNabb might have been the third best quarterback on that team.
That's the best thing I've ever heard.
And I think he's still good, but I think that was the right
move. But he had nothing to work with in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing.
Well, I mean, now we look at the Eagles. You have Michael Vick. They ended up 10-6, along with the Giants in the NFC East. However, they are the number...
They didn't have to play the Cowboy game. They could have just sent the JV out
there. They ended up 10-6. They played Kevin Cobb. Now, you look at the Packers. They have a lot of momentum going into this game. They're on a bit of a roll. Aaron Rodgers... To me, he is an elite quarterback. He's tremendous. And I think the Packers are going to win. I really think they're going to go into Philadelphia, and I think they're going to win this game.
Well, I'll tell you what. If that happens, Philly fans should just shut up about their whole we own New York thing. Because you might beat us during the regular season, but when the Giants and the Yankees and the Rangers, well, maybe not the Knicks.
The Devils.
But when's the last time the Sixers won a title, for crying out loud? 83? I think that was their last title before, if I'm not mistaken, was it the Sixers in 83 or was it the Phillies in 80?
It was the Phillies were in 80. The Sixers won in 83.
Yeah. All right. So let's calm down with the Philadelphia owns New York. Yeah. And you know who you are because someone tweeted it. At the very least, you are leasing New York with an option to buy somewhere in the distant future. Giants have three Super Bowl trophies. Eagles have the big Zippo.
Haven't won since 1960.
Right. The Bednarik game.
Right.
Well, that was the Giant game.
Right.
Where he knocked out Bednarik, or Bednarik knocked out Gifford and said, this game is over.
Yeah.
Stood over his lifeless body. He could have been dead for all we knew if you saw that video or the picture. But the Eagles haven't won since 60. The Flyers haven't won anything since the 70s. The Phillies, I'll give you the Phillies, especially with their rotation this year. But
they still lost to the Yankees.
They did, 2009. What happened with the New York-Philly rivalry there? You own us? Really? Because we have the ring. You don't. I love it. I love it. Oh, I hope Philly fans made it this far into the podcast. I really hope you did, because I love jabbing it in there. But I think Joey's absolutely right. I think this week, and if you noticed Vic, the last couple of weeks of the season, and it started with the Giants.
Those shots are starting to get at him.
It started with the Giants and how to defend him. They blitzed him from the front side and made him scramble to his non-throw, to his right, so he was throwing against his body. The Bears did the same thing, and they destroyed the Eagles. And a great thing that was invented a long time ago, Vince Lombardi even used it, film. You don't think the Packers have noticed this? And he's been forced into turnovers. All joking aside, he hasn't been as crisp as he was.
He hasn't been. And you know what? He actually has shown a little bit that it's not just
Packers
the way he's
played.
Packers
have one of the best defenses in the NFL and one of the best defensive backfields in the NFL. So
I
if Deshaun
agree.
Jackson think he's doing snow angels this weekend.
Charles Woodson's not going to let that happen.
And someone's going to drill that guy before his career is over. And I know he got hit this year and he almost got his teeth knocked out from that helmet-to-helmet hit. And I'm not saying someone's going to be dirty, but someone's going to put their shoulder.
I agree.
Because you don't do that. You saw what happened with Terrell Owens and spiking the ball on the star. You know, guys in any league are very competitive. And when you do something to show them up to that capacity, sooner or later, you're going to be writing checks and your body ain't going to be able to cash them anymore because someone's going to come and drill you.
You know, it's funny you mentioned that, you know, they're going to be coming at Michael Vick from the right side, the left side. Don't forget, they're going to be coming up the middle with B.J. Raji, who's having an unbelievable season. Yeah. Clay Matthews, A.J. Hawk.
In a way.
Charles Woodson.
In a way, I'm glad that the Packers won that game. Because I would rather see the Packers in Philly than the Giants with two losses in the back of their head already this season and the way they lost both games going into that stadium and trying to beat the Eagles. I don't even think that would have been a game. But the Packers...
Well, with Knicks out and Smith
they were
out,
injured.
And...
Yeah, but still, with those two bad losses in the back of their head. And the one, by the way, Giant fans, myself included, anytime the Eagles are down, guess what video is going to come up? That is going to... As long as you live, as long as your life takes you, as long as you keep breathing, we get it, Chris, you will see that. Anytime they're down, if you're down by 28, if you're down by 3, cue the tape up. That will live in every tape machine.
In America.
For the rest of time.
Yeah.
And you could thank your beloved New York Football Giants for spinning the bit and making you go through that and making you say, again, really? Yes. Because it's justified. Wow, I really need to quit the caffeine. But I only do it when we do this.
That's true, just to keep the spirits up.
Yeah, you know.
Well, this was a good show, Chris.
Yeah,
we got Jim Cott.
Jim Cott, you and I talking football for an hour.
Banter. not bad.
Well, this is our first one of the new year. It is sponsored, by the way, once again, by DirecTV. The Off the Wall podcast brought to you by, which used to be no one, but now it's someone, and it's someone that we love. DirecTV. Don't just watch it. DirecTV. Don't just watch TV. DirecTV. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. For Joe Auriemma, I am your host with the boast, the irrepressible, the omnipotent, omnipresent, omniscient.
The irreplaceable.
I don't know about that. Chris Sheeran, we'll see you next week, everybody, for another Off the Wall podcast brought to you by DTV.